And hello, good people of the internet. It is I, Tommy Kelly. This is Adventures in Woo-Woo, and welcome to episode 3. In this episode, I want to talk a bit about my views and opinions and interest in thought forms. I suppose of all of the things I am best known for, the 40 servants would be that. And while, you know, we call them, or I call them, predominantly servitors, what I actually do mean is thought forms. And I want to unpack all of that a little bit, because I think people talk an awful lot about things like servitors, egregores, tulpas, larvae, spirit attachments, ideas, idea space, all of these things. And sometimes they mean the same things, and sometimes they don't. And there's sometimes overlap between the different terms that it's hard to delineate or kind of understand where the boundaries of each are. What is the difference between a sigil and a servitor? What is the difference between a servitor and an egregore? What is the difference between a pendulum from reality to transurfing and a demonic attachment? So all of these things are what I'm going to talk about and look at in this episode. But I think the place to start is where I first came across the idea of thoughts being things. Part 1, Turbo Thought. So back when I was about 11, 12, 13, something like that, I think probably 12 is the best estimate, I came across the work of Stuart Wilde. Stuart Wilde was the darling of the New Age movement in the 80s and completely lost favour with that whole entire scene by the end of his career. So much so that what his early work, if you want, is a complete and utter opposite reflection of what his later work became. His early work is very funny, very witty, very irreverent, very actionable, very positive, and, you know, you would read it and feel really good about wanting to live and be a spiritual being, whereas later works are very depressing, very about end of world, demon attacks, very dark, you know, that things all falling apart, all of that type of stuff. He said, though, in his early books that he, at some stage of his life, he will write the books he wanted to. So I'm assuming that the books he wanted to write were the end books rather than the beginning books. But in the beginning, he was a very different character and very charismatic. And huge influence on me, despite all his numerous foibles and dysfunction. I actually did meet him. And of all of the people I have met, spiritual people I have met, and it's not a tremendous amount, but of all of the people I've met, he's definitely the most impressive from an energetic point of view or a charismatic point of view or that. He's also probably the most dysfunctional. So there you go. That is the nature of gurus, it seems. His first book is a book called Miracles, which is one of those law of attraction, the secret type books. It was a huge success and sold how many copies? I don't know. Let's say millions. It's a very small book. It originally is less than 50 pages or so. I think it was one of those little mini books, and then that was reprinted as a kind of more oversized thin book. But in Miracles, it's essentially put out to the universe what it is that you want. Shoot for the moon and you'll get it all. And it's, you know, that's par for the course in New Age circles, but it's kind of a very low resolution version of this idea of thought forms that was coming out of things like Theosophy and many other things, like I suppose the whole positive thinking movement of Norman Vincent Peale and New Thought and stuff like that, which again, even those two are, I suppose, if you want to be uncharitable, could call it a low resolution version of, you know, these ideas that are very prevalent now in both New Age and chaos magic circles. But it's not, that's not the book, I suppose, that, even though that was the first book I read of Stuart Wilde, that's not the book that where I really kind of understood the idea of thoughts or things, if you want. And that's a sentence that is, you know, you spend any time in the New Age and you're going to come across that fairly quickly. In his book, The Quickening, which is the fourth book of a series of books, which are called the Taoist Quintet, which you have Miracles, Affirmations, The Force and The Quickening. And he's obviously clearly influenced by movies over his lifetime, because obviously The Force would be from, you know, influence from Star Wars. The Quickening is from Highlander, as far as I remember. And then he gets absolutely obsessed with The Matrix when that comes out years later. But in The Quickening, he talks about this idea of turbo thought. And in turbo thought is a thought that, in essence, that you are able to put out into the world and have it manifest. So it's a bit more like a higher, if you want, higher resolution version of, you know, positive thinking or just putting it out there to the universe. There's a bit more of a magical, particularly a kind of a chaos magical feel to it. Now, he certainly wouldn't call himself a chaos magician, but there's definitely a chaos magic approach, or you could look at it through a chaos magic lens. And the first kind of thing that he talks about is he calls them etheric exercises. And etheric is another one of these words that is a bit like thought forms, where many people use to describe different things. I often think that etheric, Stuart Wilde's talking about, is possibly something like the causal body rather than an astral body or something like that. But it doesn't matter. It's like the second body. So the body invisible to the naked eye that can be sensed, but is as much a real part of the universe as the physical body is. And the first of these ideas, or the first of these kind of trainings, or the first of these practical things that you can do, was this idea of getting people to turn around and look at you. And it's not quite the same as the sense of being stared at that, you know, you have with Rupert Sheldrake. It's to actually make a concerted effort in order to get strangers or people not connected to you or not talking to you to look at you by use of this turbo-taut idea, or this, you know, the etheric double. And so it's the very first thing you do is you pick a target, and you visualize yourself and have the feeling and the thought of being right up close to the back of their neck, so that you can almost feel like you're breathing on their neck. You know, very creepy. And then, even creepier, you lick the back of their neck. In your mind, of course, you're not running up to these people and actually licking the back of their necks. I'm sure they would turn around to you if you did that. And what the idea is that this in some way disturbs their aura or their field or their energy, or in some way to take notice of you. And this sounds ridiculous, of course, other than the fact that it actually really works. And you can demonstrate this yourself quite effectively by doing it. Now, there is definitely an element of practice to this. I got really, really good at this back in the day, to the point that I could, you know, do it on demand and get skeptics to, you know, say, pick a person and I'll get them to turn around and look at me. And invariably it would. It was rare that it didn't. But then I stopped doing it, stopped practicing for whatever. I didn't feel the need to impress people or get people to look at me anymore. And then I tried it a number of times since, and I'm not anywhere near as effective as I once was. So there is a practice element to it, you know, and it's not something I'll probably spend a lot of time practicing. But it's something of interest that you can do to start getting in the mode of having an idea that a thought in your head can have a tangible effect on the world out there. He has another one where he talks about sitting in a park or in somewhere busy, somewhere where people are going to walk past you, and visualizing a stick coming out from your hand in the way of the people who will, you know, be walking past. And the idea is to, as much as possible, try and have it as tangible in your mind as possible and, you know, really project it out there and see if you can trip people up. And he says if you find it hard to trip people up, you know, add a kind of an extra visualization as people walk past to give them a shove with your other hand. Now, I was very, very unsuccessful with doing this. It was not something I was ever really able to do. But I didn't spend as much time on this one as I did the other one, because I kind of got an effect from the turning around game fairly quick, where I just give up, essentially, on this one. But it's interesting then that other people have similar ideas or similar kind of things. There's a woman called Helen Hadsell, who's known as the Contest Queen. And she's an interesting woman in that she won loads of things, you know, entered loads of contests, TV game shows or whatever it is, or raffles. I don't know exactly, but she, you know, to the point where she won statistically more than she should have. She had a very high rate of winning these things. She won, you know, like even to the point of she won a house. There's a good interview, well, it's absolute potato quality, but I'll put it in the show description, of her talking about a similar type of idea there to the stick idea, where she talks about this, the thing of projecting a silver dollar in front of her to see if other people would notice it. Because she was very interested in going, well, if I can in some way get this very clear in my head and project it out into the world, wouldn't it be interesting if other people could see it? And so she did this. And she says in the video that what she found is that a kid could see it and was trying to pick it up, but clearly couldn't. And then some older man came and said to her, I know what you're doing, or I can see what you're doing. Not in a kind of a threatening way, just kind of in a, you know, I acknowledge what you're doing. And she's kind of saying that it's interesting her in the middle of her life doing this, and that it was young people and older people that seemed to pick up on it more. And I suppose there's a thing in that is that, you know, have people at that stage when you're a child, have you still your wonder, you're still able to see, you know, magic in the way that you can't when you get kind of caught up in life. And then again, does that return at the end? Or was it just one of those coincidences or events that was just a young person and an old person that happened on this day? So that's kind of the kind of basic idea of turbo thought. But Stuart, he goes into more kind of, I suppose in one way you could look at it as a bit more nefarious, or at least it could be used nefariously, putting thoughts directly into other people's minds or brains to the point of they think it's their own thought. And he kind of says that, you know, you're going to have to decide for yourself what is moral and what is immoral to do with regard to this, because as far as he was concerned, it clearly worked. For me, I've been thinking an awful lot about the kind of moralistic thing around doing magic. And you know, what is acceptable, what isn't, what you should be doing and what you shouldn't be doing, and, you know, what is a good magical target and what is, you know, in a sense, cheating. And one of the things that's often touted around this idea is Alan Moore's sage advice, where he's talking about with regard to love magic or sex magic, in the sense of getting someone to have sex with you rather than magic that is done by the act of sex. And he's saying, like, would you roofie someone in order to have sex with them in your real life? Was that something you would do? Then why do you think it's appropriate or moralistically okay to use magic in order to get someone to, you know, have sex with you or whatever it is? And I think that that's pretty good advice. And I think you can kind of put it on its head too, where you can kind of look at stuff that you're not doing magic for and ask yourself, why is that? Because in many ways, your spiritual goals should be the same as your physical goals, you know, your mundane goals as well. Because if they're not, then what's going on there? Why is there a lack of an alignment? Why are you not using magic to fulfill your wants, needs, desires on the material level? I think some of the answers to that can be because, you know, it's seen as cheating in some way, that, you know, you're not really deserving of it or something like that. And I think there is a thing in that, but I think that's only if you're actually using magic to cheat. I can give you an example of this. A couple of years ago, I joined a local photography club, and every month we had a photography competition wherein you put in whatever it was, six images, three color, three black and white, and you got judged, and there was a winner at the end of you were marked out of 20. But no one really ever got below 14 or 15 or something. There was an occasional 12. So at the time, I was thinking, that is a perfect target for magic in order to win, you know, to get the best picture of the week. Or the month. That, I think, is one of the things that is kind of, if you go to do magic for a target to win something like that, is in a sense, you know, cheating. And so that's cheating magic. And why is that? It's cheating because you're trying to fool people in a sense of giving you something that you mightn't have earned or deserved. If it was just the sake of wanting to win the thing, why not just cheat, outright cheat, and, you know, take someone else's photo that's exceptional or whatever that you know will win and present it as your own or something like that. You know, it kind of feels similar to that, to do magic to win something, in a sense, unearned. And I suppose that the best magic around that and how it would align more with, I suppose, my spiritual outlook, if you want, would be to do magic to be inspired, to be worthy of winning, you know, the photo of the month, to have the knowledge, the skill, and use all the magic towards that kind of a thing so that you come up with a great image. And, you know, so it's more of a booster to your natural things that you were doing in your life. You're trying to be a better photographer. You're trying to create better art. So it's more pushing in that direction rather than a kind of a cheat. And so that's when I say that I think this should be aligned. If you're trying to be a better photographer or a writer or a footballer or a swimmer, whatever it is, then the magic thing should align with that, and you should be doing magic for that to become better. Now, I think where you step over the mark is where you go, I will win the swimming competition even though I know I am not fit to win, or I'm not in a position to win, or I haven't done enough to win. You know, that's kind of a cheating thing. But that's going to be up to you to decide. But I think that kind of notion of why, you know, would I do something magically that I wouldn't do in my real life is a good question to ask. And also, why am I not using magic for my personal goals? What is it that I feel I'm undeserving of, that I would be cheating? Or, you know, this is also just kind of a notion as well, I suppose, that you're, you know, what's for you won't pass you. And that if it's, you know, you're not meant to, I suppose, in one sense, ask for these things, or, you know, you're being greedy, or, you know, we have all of these kind of notions that, you know, you're not meant to have stuff. Because an awful lot of spirituality, I've talked before, seems to be that you must shun the world, material existence, that it's an illusion, or even if it's not an illusion, it's a thing to overcome. It's not sort of something that should be indulged. You have to get rid of all your wants and desires and become anything other than human, you know, like. But I mean, the dysfunctional version of the opposite of that is, of course, materialism. And you don't want, that's not what I'm talking about. But if you have a life goal and you're not using magic for it, then you have to question, is that a moralistic life goal? Because, like, why aren't you doing magic for it? If you think you deserve it, or you think you want it, or it's something that you want for life, why wouldn't you be doing magic for it? To put another example of, if you were doing a job interview, or you're going in and having a job interview, you put your best foot forward, you know, you do the best CV you could, you know, you'd be dressed the best way you could, or the most appropriate way, you'd be putting a good foot forward and all that. Is that all cheating? And I don't think we feel that it is cheating in many ways. So what would be the extra thing of doing some magic for it, to have a positive outcome, to have a probabilistic better chance of getting the job or whatever? But, you know, it seems to be that we also have this feeling that, well, if I do that, something bad is going to happen, you know, but we don't feel that something bad is going to happen if we do the mundane things. So there's some sort of thing that's out of whack or out of alignment there. So anyway, why I'm talking about the job interview is because one of the examples that Stuart gives about the turbo thought is in a job interview, where he talks about going in and placing a thought in the person's head in which you say, give me the job or whatever. I'll actually read the process so that you can best understand what he's saying. You would concentrate solely on their forehead, at the space between their eyes. As he talks, pull a quantum of life force up from your root chakra and see yourself inside the ball of energy. You're going to fire that turbo thought into the interviewer's mind, so that the turbo thought in this case would be, give me the job, or I am the perfect candidate, or I'm easy to get on with, or whatever it is. Back to Stuart. Thus, you visualize a line of light entering the interviewer via his root chakra, running up his spine into his right brain. Fire your thought form along the line of light, expelling a short breath as you do. Have the thought form explode in his brain like a shower of God force. Once the thought is fired, back off. He does talk about trying to work out if someone's left-handed or right-handed so that you fire it into the opposing side of the brain or something, but it seems slightly convoluted. Maybe need it. If it's not working for you, maybe think along those lines. When I was at college and we were doing holistic health studies, I talked about this to some of the people I was in class with, and we tried to test it out, whatever, and we tried to put the word sausage, which is a random word, into the lecturers or the teachers, you know, as they were talking. We tried to get the inserters to get them to say sausage. I mean, we could never do it. The best we could do was that we got them to be confused a bit, or got them to kind of stumble over their words. But I mean, they could have been doing that naturally anyway. But, you know, when you're hyper-vigilant to seeing if your thing has an effect, you start to see patterns that might necessarily aren't there. But I have known people who've done it. A friend of mine, Dave, years and years ago, we used to live together, and we had talked about this type of thing. And he did it to me a number of times, where he would put a thought in my head and he'd get me to say something or ask a question or something like that. So I've been on the receiving end of it. And it kind of feels quite intrusive in one way. You kind of, like, I remember one time he was doing it, and I felt like I was kind of in one way involuntary asking a question, and I felt a bit uneasy around it. So I mean, I definitely don't dismiss it as something. It's worth trying it, but I mean, it's a grey area. And again, if you feel it's cheating, or if you feel it's, you know, not the most moralistic thing to do, then perhaps back away from it. But I'm sure there is some great and wonderful white magic you could do with it in order to get some service rendered in the world that would be better for everyone concerned. Can you hear outside the torrential rain? This is Ireland. I'm doing this in a square tin can box, and so it's quite noisy. Hopefully it's not coming through on the recording. So that was kind of my first introduction to the idea of thoughts being things, if you want. But let's get into part two. Part two, servitors. So at the end of the interview, where Helen Hansel is talking about the silver dollar that I talked about in the first part, she talks about this idea of having her own doctor that she has created, a thought form of a doctor who she consults with, who she often feels is more wise, more insightful than her actual doctors. And this is closer, I suppose, to a type of thought form that we would have in chaos magic, which is a servitor. A servitor is essentially an idea that you put together in order to fulfill a task. And there's overlap with servitors. What is a servitor and what is a sigil? What is a servitor and what is an egregore? And I think that the harder kind of delineation is between sigil and servitor, because they're quite similar. Whereas, strictly speaking, an egregore is a thought form that is created by a group of people for a group need or for a group result. Whereas a sigil is usually for a singular person for a singular result, whereas a servitor is a singular person creating a thought form for an ongoing, I suppose, kind of result. But what happens if someone creates a servitor that then gets used by a number of people, like the 40 servants or DKMU or something like that? Does it that then become not a servitor and become an egregore? What if you have an egregore where you've created a thought form created by a number of people, but then only gets used by one person? Does it stop being an egregore and become just a servitor? At what point does a sigil become a servitor? You know, if you have a sigil for a continued good luck, is that a sigil or is it a servitor? And I think the answer to all of that is that labels are useless and stupid, and you should stop trying to put everything into boxes. But probably not not very helpful when you're trying to have a conversation with people. Of course, there is other things as well that would come into this, where you have the idea of a tulpa. Now, tulpas get a bad press, and probably rightly so. And most of the blame is usually put onto Helena Petrova Blavatsky, for it's either touted as a wrong translation or a wrong understanding of the Tibetan Buddhism sprulpa, which is an emanation of some sort of high ideal of some sort of bodhisattva or something like that. But to be fair, and I have said that myself, that I've often touted that, or not often, but on occasions where it does come up around tulpa, I've certainly said it in Tasta, I would have reiterated the thought that let's all blame good old Blavatsky. But having actually looked into it, I don't think it's her fault at all, and it seems to be a later thing. She does talk about thought forms, but if you put in tulpa into a PDF, you know, of The Secret Doctrine or Isis Unveiled or The Voices of Silence right now, it's not in any of that. There is this idea of thought forms in Theosophy, but it seems to have come much later with the book Thought Forms, which came out in 1905 and was written by C.W. Leadbetter and Annie Besant. And that talks about thought forms in a way. But the actual kind of thing of tulpas seems to be the fault, if you would, of a woman by the name of Alexandra David Neal. And she seems to be the one who said that she witnessed this creation of a tulpa in a Buddhist setting somewhere in Tibet and stuff like that. So we can't rightly blame Blavatsky. Now, of course, I haven't extensively looked into this. I just kind of briefly looked into it to make sure that if I did mention that it is Blavatsky's fault, that it is her fault. And I couldn't find anything. Phil Hine has some good posts around this. And if you go to the wiki for thought forms or tulpas, Blavatsky's not mentioned at all. And as I said, if you do a search in the PDF of any of our major works, it's not mentioned either. But anyway, what is a tulpa? A tulpa is kind of like a servitor, other than it has its own kind of autonomy and its own sovereignty and its own sentience, and it's more closely aligned. This is the modern day version of tulpa, not the actual thing that was in Tibetan Buddhism, which is very little really anything to do with tulpas. So tulpa is mostly seen as an imaginary friend, as a companion, something like that, that has its own volition, if you want. And it's these tulpas that seem to be the things that cause the idea that servitors, if you leave them long enough, will start wrecking your life. Because of this idea of that they have an independent kind of separate existence from you and their own kind of ideas of what they want to be and have kind of an evolution into something else. Which I don't think, in my experience of servitors, it certainly isn't the case. I mean, the 40 servants have been used by many people over many times, over many years, and haven't fundamentally changed the nature, or haven't at all changed in their nature. The healer is still the healer. The moon is still the moon. Whereas that doesn't seem to be the case with tulpas. But I often find that people, and this is, you know, this is a gross generalization, but I often find that people that have problems with servitors getting out of hand, or tulpas getting out of hand, or things becoming very erratic, tend to have lives that are quite erratic and a bit out of hand. And it seems to be more born out of that than out of the nature of servitors. But this idea of having sentience and independence and its own will, if you want, is not something that's in really the idea of thought forms in a theosophical sense. Now, being that I am a part-time theosophist, part-time chaos magician, part-time witch, whatever it is that I am, my flavour of theosophy is Alice Bailey, and it's the thing I'm most familiar with. And certainly in her case, thought forms do not have their own will. They are completely dependent on the initial idea or the initial thought that when they were formed, and they can't become something else. And that's definitely my kind of feel about what servitors are. They are what they are, and they're not going to change in nature, and they're not going to start behaving in their own way unless you so allow it, that if that is the nature that you've created. And even then, it'll be somewhat of an illusion, if you want, because it's pretending to do it, because that's what it's not pretending, it's doing it only because you're allowing it, because that's what it's programmed to do. Think of it, I suppose, in some way a bit like, although, you know, contemporary comparisons never hold up and timestamp you very, very quickly. But think of it a bit like, I suppose, like an AI or a GTP, where you've created it to be something. And if you've created it to be something that, you know, can get out of hand, then it's going to get out of hand. But if you create it to be very specific and have the boundaries in which you have the boundaries, then it will, to a large extent, stay specific. But, I mean, tulpas aren't the only place, of course, where this nature of thought forms having their own agency or their own will or their own sovereignty comes, you know, into play. In Reality Transurfing, which is by Vadim Seeland, which has become a very popular kind of outlook, and I quite like it. Of all of the kind of law of attraction, dimension, jumping type things, it's my favourite. It's the most comprehensive, and there's some really, really good ideas. And one of the ideas in it is this idea of pendulums. And in Reality Transurfing, pendulums have their own sovereignty, in a sense. They have their own will, or it's a thing that, again, closer to an egregore than a servitor, because it's seen as they are created mostly by groups and enact upon groups. So it's more of a case of like the collective thoughts and emotions of a group of people come together and form a sort of, as it's called, pendulum. But I think if you think of it more like a vortex, something that's kind of sucks you in and you become part of it. I think they use the word pendulum more because it has this kind of hypnotic effect of that you become hypnotized in some way by this particular energy or this particular habitual thought or something like that. And it's seen that, you know, the pendulum itself gets fed by people buying into it, by people giving it its energy. In a sense, it's kind of like an energy vampire type thing, where this pendulum is sucking the life soul or the energy out of people in order to sustain itself, as opposed to, strictly speaking, servitors or thought forms, in the sense how I see them or how Alice Bailey's theosophy would see them, is that they are fed on attention and attention alone. Once you, you know, take away the attention, then they stop existing. Many people have different thoughts on the whole feeding of servitors, in that they, you know, many, many different ways of doing it. I've never found it any way effective other than attention, and I think it's by far the best because it's the easiest to dissolve then as well. You just forget about them. But there's many different ways. But in the case of pendulums, it's seeing as it's literally feeding on the people. And the only way to kind of get out of this is to remove yourself from the situation and not let the pendulum affect on you. You know, not contribute to it, if you want. And a good example of a pendulum is your family. You know, say you get to a family gathering at Christmas. There's rules, there's an understanding, there's a group dynamic, there's a hierarchy, there is things you can talk about, things you can't talk about. There's, you know, people who have a certain role. You know, some are the kind of the angry person, some are the kind of the sheepish person, some are the, you know, the black sheep or whatever. Whatever is the dynamic. But there is this kind of unwritten rule, if you want, that is the pendulum of your family. And it's very hard to get out of that, because you find yourself, when you go into this situation, that you almost become a different person. You become the person that is within that pendulum. It's a bit like if you ever find yourself in the company of two different sets of friends that don't know each other. So you have people from, say, from work, and then you have people from who knew you when you were at school or something. And you find there's a very weird kind of sense going on, that you're caught between, I suppose, in a sense, two pendulums, where you're trying to be the person you are at work, and you're trying to be the person that you are to the person you went to school with. And you find that it's very uncomfortable, at least I do. Anyway, because, you know, you're being kind of pulled in two different directions or whatever. And of course, I mean, this can extend not just to families and work things, but can extend more into like political and social and cultural kind of movements, ideologies, you know, fashions, cultural trends, you know, all of these memes, like all of this kind of stuff. But in Reality Transurfing, I would definitely be seeing that these have their own agency, you know, that their own thing. It's not just a thought form per se, it becomes something else, or it's almost like an entity. And you see this in a number of other things. I have come across it in things like shamanism or kind of neo-shamanism or Western shamanism or Americanized shamanism, if you want. I'm not overly familiar with original shamanism. So I can only talk about my dealings in the kind of neo stuff, where it's seen as like their spirit attachments, or sometimes hear it be described as larvae attach themselves. You know, that these thought forms or these ideas become an entity in themselves. I was in one kind of healing, let me see, therapeutic setting in a more spiritual sense rather than an actual counselling or therapy thing. And the person said to me that these things, whatever you want to call them, they would be called samskaras in Vedic or Indian kind of thought. It'd be like pathologies in the philosophical midwifery of Pierre Grimes, habitual thoughts, hang-ups, neuroses, you know, all these kind of habitual patterns, whatever, that play out in your life. And it was described as these are actual fucking demons, you know, actual demonic entities. And it wasn't being described in a kind of figurative or metaphorical sense, but in that it adds an actual demon. And that's kind of, I suppose, the furthest you can go, and I suppose into from going from that their thought forms, ideas, into, you know, then become in some way actual entities. And while I'm open to all kind of things, and, you know, perhaps that is true, I kind of weigh with the sense of that, well, that's really not helpful in many ways. You know, it's fine saying it to, in one sense, to me, who can take it or leave it. But I think that by telling people, whether it's true or not, that the reason that you have a certain, you know, the reason that you are sad or the reason you are angry or whatever is because of a demon attached to you, or it's a demon fooling you into something else, whatever. And not in a figurative self, not in like something like the demon drink, you know, or his personal demons, but like an actual demons, not a figurative or metaphorical, literal demons. You know, imagine you went into an actual counselling session or a therapy session. We'd have and go, well, I have this interaction with my dad for my entire life, and this is the relationship. And, you know, the therapist said, oh, well, it's demons. You would leave fairly quickly. Like, and I think there's also a kind of sense, not only do I think it's unhelpful in that it would freak people out, and, you know, it kind of gives too much power to these things, that undue power, things that I don't think they necessarily have. That if you have the idea that you have a habitual thought that is in some way is interacting with you, you know, even could be passed down through generations or whatever, that you now have decided that it is an external thing, that it's a demon or it's a larvae or it's a spirit attachment or it's, you know, a pendulum with its own volition and its own sovereignty or whatever, you're kind of giving it an awful lot of power that it mightn't necessarily have, where you can, you know, it's just, no, this is a habitual thought. This is a repeating pattern. This is a samskara. This is a neuroses or whatever it is. It's less powerful in that way. And I can understand, and I would probably gain an awful lot from a very chaos magic point of view of attacking some of these kind of neuroses or thought forms or habitual things by seeing them as demons that need to be bound or exorcised or something like that. But I don't know, I think it's more harmful than helpful for the vast majority of people to think of thought forms of having their own power, their own volition, their own autonomy, or that they're in some way actual entities or something like that. But again, as I say, I'm as open to all of it as I possibly can. I just, it's not necessarily my experience either, as I say, of thought forms, that they have agency in the way people fear they have agency, or in a demonic agency or whatever. But, you know, who knows? Who knows? So just to, I suppose, go back and reiterate my thoughts of what their way to look at them is, what I think the 40 servants are, which are thought forms, in the same way that, as we talked at the beginning, that Helen Hadsell has this kind of doctor thing where she has created a thought form of doctor that she can interact with. Or I suppose even Carl Jung's active imaginations, where he interacts with the same type of people over and over again and develops kind of a relationship. But you often hear of people having like an inner council or whatever, where they've set up these wise people who they can tell their problems to or get some sort of insight or whatever. They're more an embodiment of a certain type of thought. From my point of view, I think of servitors as ideas, as thoughts, as a kind of demarcation or a delineation, a kind of putting a particular idea into a particular form. I know that's just another way of saying thought form, but rather than giving life to a spirit. People always say to me, are 40 servants like spirits? And they're not. I don't think they are. From my point of view, they're not. Number one, because who am I to be able to create a spirit? And I suppose then the people go, oh, well, they were created before and they just kind of channeled through you and, you know, they picked you to be seen or something. And, well, number one, they could have picked someone better who was better able at marketing and getting the word out in them than me. But also, I was there when I created them, you know, and while some of it overall feels a very magical channeled effect, not in the way Abraham Hicks is channeled, or not in the way Dwal Kool was channeled, or not in the way Bashir, whatever his name is. It's not like that. It's very similar to the creative aspect where you just try to get out of the way of what it is and let it be whatever it wants to be. In the same way that writing a song is for me, or anything I do, it's just kind of letting it arrive. And you hear musicians and artists and talking about that all the time. And I do feel it is different than actual channeling, in that I think it's probably more real. It's the more real thing. And I think an awful lot of the low resolution kind of channeling is this kind of pretending, putting on a silly voice and pretending you're an Egyptian master or something like that. But again, open to all of it. I'm sure there is genuine channeling and in the kind of Egyptian stupid voiced type, you know, close on racist impression of an old Chinese person or something like that. And so the 40 servants for me don't have a personal volition or sovereignty or autonomy. Like, clearly they have something in the sense of that I created these things and now they're out in the world and have a life of their own that doesn't involve me and I will never know of, you know, that people have a personal interaction with them and stuff like that. So, I mean, there's some sort of sense of they have their own being. But what I mean is that they're going to suddenly come up with their own idea, have their own agenda, and change in their nature is what I don't think is going to happen. And it's not my experience of it. Like the healer, as I say, it's always going to be the healer. It's not suddenly going to become the wrecker, or, you know, the father's always going to be an embodiment of the father. And it's not going to suddenly become, you know, the abuser or something like that. The only thing I suppose that where it would seem that a servitor or thought form would change in nature is more that our understanding of what its role is changes, rather than it's actually changing. And an example would be, say you had a 40 servant and it was created a number of years ago. It was called the meek. And originally, the meek meant someone who is humble, you know, unassuming, gentle, modest, and not easily provoked. You know, this kind of, you know, has patience, not easily rattled, humility, something like that. It's meek. And so that's what this, you know, you create this servitor, this thought form, which is that. But of course, then the nature of what the meek meant has changed over a while, where now it kind of means someone who's weak or submissive, almost cowardly or something like that. And, you know, if you were looking at a servant or servitor that's the meek and you're going, well, why is this person so unassuming and not easily rattled? I thought the meek was meant to be submissive and weak and cowardly and, you know, not, won't stand up for itself or whatever it is. So whatever we have about the meek, kind of timid and retiring or something like that. And so our idea has changed around it. But I'm not necessarily sure that that's the case with all of these things. Again, going back to with regard to like tulpas and, you know, the kind of nature of them becoming destructive, can also come in some way that you're putting, the same way what I was talking about with regard to demonizing these things or calling them entities, or you're externalizing something and you're giving it more power than it should have. You know, people often say to me that they don't like calling the 40 servants servants in a kind of way that makes me think that they're actually calling them slaves, which is of course not what it is. Slave and servant are two different words, clearly two different words, two different ideas as well. You know, that then the kind of put these things on a pedestal rather than something that works for you. It's something that you have to petition. It's something that you have to ask permission for. It's something you have to kind of beg and plead with in order to work. And so the dynamic of it changes dramatically, where you've given all the power away to your servitor or your thought form, rather than it being something that helps you or works for you or is created by you for a particular reason or outcome or desire. And once you start getting into that kind of territory, then, you know, all bets are off in many ways, because you've given all of your agency, all of your sovereignty, all of your autonomy, all of your thing over to something else. So keeping the kind of hierarchy of your thought forms as that you are the boss and they are the employee. You can be a good boss. You don't have to be a slave driver. You don't have to treat them as slaves. But having the dynamic of these thought forms are your creation or under your kind of command, you know, is a healthy kind of way to look at it, to not let it get into the kind of sense of where it becomes an external demonic larvae entity that has its own volition, will, and, you know, destructive means. But I guess with like things like the 40 servants and servitors and tulpas, less so with pendulums, but all of these kind of things are things that you have deliberately made in order to affect change in the world, or to in some way get a desire, or to become a better, you know, have a better life experience or whatever. But what about stuff that rather than from coming from you is coming from outside?
Part 3, outside influences.
So I guess given that we know we can create our own thought forms, we can create our own servitors, egregores, we can, you know, have our tulpas if we so desire, that would imply that like we're not the only people who can do this. And that this has been happening for a long while. And so there's probably plenty of these ideas out there already, thought forms knocking around. And you can certainly see them as we talk in the more kind of pendulumistic sense of, you know, groups, dynamics, families, cultural rules, society rules, things that have been handed down over the years and all that kind of inform who we are, how we think, what, you know, we think our morals are, what we think is decency, well, you know, what we think is just, who we think the enemy is, who we think friends are, you know, what we feel is appropriate, what's inappropriate. All of these things are thought forms. In theosophy, there's a number of things that are called planes, which are different kind of parts of reality, but seen as part of the actual material universe, if you want, just that on either a more refined level or just in a different vibration, man. And one of these planes is the mental plane. And theosophy would state that all thought forms start and are created on the mental plane, which is the intellectual plane, your mind. You know, that it's this thing that our current evolution is what we're working towards, having that as, that's what we're working on. This is where we are. This is where our current point in evolution is, to create the mental or the mind, or to perfect it. And so when you first have a thought form, you first have a thought. Like, I mean, it's the beginning of the world, and this happens on the mental plane. But it doesn't become a thought form until it's given, or it is attached, feeling to it. And the feeling plane of existence is the astral plane. And this is the emotional plane, or the feelings plane, as I say. Of course, there's different kind of ideas of what the astral plane is. But in the sense of the Alice Baileyan theosophy, the astral plane is the feeling emotional plane. And it's said that it's almost nearly a direct one-for-one version of the physical plane, other than it's not, you know, it's not a true reflection of what's there. And it's said that if you take away the physical world entirely, that you would see the astral, like, not exact, not really, but like, I mean, just in this example, you would see most people would see the astral world and not really see any different. You know, it would be that kind of exact, but in exact in that it's completely, but completely delusional about it. I think this is kind of where the nature of the universe or the world is an illusion stems from in some ways. Not necessarily, but it's an interesting kind of way to look at it. That it's not that the world is an illusion, it's that this astral plane, this thing that we feel about it, these feelings we've had, these thought forms, this kind of sense that we have about it, the emotions around it, means that we are delusional and we have superimposed our feelings and our thoughts on what is real. And that's the illusion. So it's not that the world is an illusion, it's what we're delusional about it. And it's like, so that you literally, as a jealous person, will see stuff, you know, that's not necessarily happening. I suppose in many ways it's how we understand what things are. But what we're never looking at things as they are. We're looking at things while thinking about them or having a feeling about them, which is not necessarily what they are. It's like how do we know what a table is or what a chair is? Like, there's a million different chairs. And I know there's kind of this notion of Plato's thing was that there's an actual chair design that, you know, that we compare it to, or there's a divine chair or something like that. But it's like, why we can't look at something and not see something, you know? And this is all astral plane. So in order to have, like, your thoughts become more than just, you know, a thought in your head, it has to be imbued with some sort of feeling, emotion or something. And so we would have to imagine then that this astral plane that surrounds us is just littered with stuff that isn't, you know, a true reflection of what the world is, you know. And maybe we'd have to be pretty aware of this and pretty cognizant of it, given, you know, the amount of that we can see media, propaganda and stuff like that. So we know an awful lot of what we know about the world isn't probably true, and that we know that history is written by the people who won, and, you know, that's probably not a true reflection of the state of history or whatever. You know, it's like, it's not a lie in a sense, but it's just not the proper, it's a delusional kind of look at things. I was reading a book to my son, it's The Horrible Histories, and it's about Egypt, and it's talking about a particular battle where we have records from both Egyptians and Hittites or something, I can't remember the name of the other tribe, and they both have a history of the battle where, from the Egyptian point of view, they won a glorious victory, but from the other side, their historical records say they won the glorious victory. They can't both be true, but yeah, that's, you know, that's the way it's presented. And if you were part of the Egyptian pendulum, if you want, that is your history. So we must be just absolutely and utterly surrounded by this, you know, particularly, you know, family stuff, cultural stuff, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And so I thought about this a number of years ago, like, one way of the kind of think of it is to think of yourself as a planet, you know, that you are a planet. And this is kind of where the idea of the actual planet from the 47s came out. You know, this is kind of what you have in your gravity, that you've all this kind of debris and clutter all kind of around the planet, you know, that it's just kind of floating around because of your gravitational pull. And kind of see it, that all this gravitational crud, or all this kind of orbit cruds that are in the crud that is in the orbit, and all bits and pieces of old satellites, and I don't know, cars with David Bowie songs in it or whatever we send up to there. But we have all of these things around our own personal planet. We have bits that we got from our family, bits that we've got from culture, bits that we've got from fashion, bits that we've from books we've read. All of these things are all kind of floating and all around us, just all there informing us and clouding, if you want, the real or a real experience of the world. And we're seeing it through this lens, through this clutter, through all of these ideas. And we know this ourselves, that this is probably, you know, it's a good metaphor for a reality. We know that our vision is clouded because of biases, preferences, proclivities, prejudices. Prejudices and all the like. And so my idea was to have this thing, and I wrote a blog post about it, and it was about clearing your personal orbit. And I'll put it in the show description, the link to it. I'll probably do an update of it soon enough for the Redux series I'm doing on Patreon. But it's just kind of the idea of visualizing that and visualizing all the things around you and visualizing all the different impacts, all the different thoughts, thought forms, pendulums, whatever it is, that word you want to use, and visualize that you have these all in your gravity field, and they're all attracted to you because you have in some way, you're holding on to them. You know, the gravity is you holding on. You're not letting go. This is the thing. And then click off the gravity and let everything just float away from you. You know, it sounds very simplistic and very kind of new agey meditation-y, you know, this guided meditation. It's, just let your problems float away. But it's quite effective in doing that. That if you, especially if you can get the feel of it and the emotion of it, where you just stop holding on to these things, just let them go. And I use it a lot when I'm disturbed or when I'm uneasy about something, or something is worrying me or annoying me, and just try to just switch off my gravity and just let the thought form pass. Just move away from me, just no longer be part of my auric field. And that's just one kind of example of what way you engage with these thought forms and try to release them, whatever. You know, plenty of the different standard banishing techniques or clearing techniques or smudging techniques or, you know, ritual baths or cleansing fires and cord cutting and, you know, plenty of other things, you know, things, you know, therapeutic stuff, more like, I suppose, like Byron Katie's The War or philosophical midwifery, or, you know, any amount of these things that would aim at the same thing of trying to reduce, you know, these kind of habitual thought forms or repeating patterns. There's another way, and this comes from, I got this from Harish, Christopher Wallace from Tantra. His views on Tantra, and it's about having these samskaras. And samskaras are kind of, in this sense, would be undigested habitual patterns or memories or things that you haven't fully dealt with that are still kind of playing out in your mind or whatever. The idea of digest them is that when this thought comes up or this thought form arrives, and it's, you know, maybe it's an embarrassing situation or just something you haven't dealt with, you know, rather than trying to, I'm not thinking about that, try to push it away or not, you know, not engage with it. It's to fully engage with it, to let it completely and utterly be what it is, to fully feel the embarrassment, to fully feel the fear, to fully feel the, whatever it is, the hurt, the sadness, whatever, to let it absolutely be there rather than pushing it away, rather than trying to explain it away or justify it or do anything. Just allow it to be whatever it is, and to say, I take it back. It all returns to me, like in kind of a soul retrieval type of way. I digest it, I take it all in, and just let it all just return back into you, rather than this kind of notion of pushing it away. And that can be quite helpful. I find that quite helpful as well, of just allowing the situation or the thought, the memory to be. There's loads of other things you can do as well, like in an NLP sense of changing the situation so that every time you think of it becomes funny. You know, if you have a particularly horrible situation of people shouting at you or whatever, you can give them all Mickey Mouse ears, or they're all naked or whatever it is, just to make that memory, to taint it, that, you know, to inject humor into it so that it no longer has its bite or whatever. And that can work in some situations. All of these can work in some situations. Sometimes things are too ingrained or too hard or too deep or too sad or too whatever, that giving Mickey Mouse ears to the memory seems quite trite and almost insulting. So it all depends on what you're trying to do. Loving it as well. I mean, it's the old thing, isn't it? Just send love to all of these things rather than opposing. What you resist persists. You know, what you oppose seems to hang around a bit longer as well. And so if you can love these things, see it as a a beautiful manifestation of something. I don't know, that can be also quite hard to do. But it's, so it's good to have all of these kind of different notions of how you can deal with the different thought forms, whatever. But finding out what they are, you know, it's the first kind of step onto it. But there can be some thought forms that are just so embedded or so ubiquitous or so just there that we don't even know that, you know, that they're weird. That idea of an alien came down and looked at society, what would it see that we're not seeing? That something, you know, there's probably something really bizarre that we think is true or we act on that, you know, like maybe it's a case of something like money goes, oh, what are you doing? Why would you possibly have this that we all kind of buy into? But it won't be money because we can kind of see that. It'll be something that we are totally unaware of that we buy into that is totally not true. And so there's not really much you could deal about them because, you know, you can't work on something that you don't know, you know, is affecting you in a negative way. Of course, one other way of then doing, you know, getting rid of, I suppose, negative thought forms around you or whatever you want is to do the opposite and just radiate what you want rather than trying to deal or lessen or get rid of or cleanse the stuff you don't want, you know, the influences that you don't want. Again, this is another post I did a couple of years ago and it's called the radiating aura technique. And this is another thought form exercise. I found this to be immensely effective and it's so effective that I often, when I go back and I look at it, I go, why don't I do this all the time? I kind of fall out of practice with an awful lot of this stuff, but this worked really, really well. And it's about the notion of radiating out the feeling of the person you want to be or something like that. It's like NLP's kind of modeling technique, but in a chaos magic kind of way, where you try on the clothes of someone who is the person that you want to be and then pretend you are that person, but you radiate it with all your being, you push it out, you visualize, you have the feeling, the emotions. I'll just read the actual technique for you and see what you make of it as originally written. So the radiating aura technique, I will put the links in the show description. Number one, decide what sort of quality you would like to radiate. So this could be like confidence, beauty, sexiness, intelligence, happiness, hope, whatever it is you want. Number two, try to understand and feel what it must like to be a person who feels like that. Think about how they would feel physically, mentally, and emotionally. So that, like, if you want to, you know, if you want to radiate good looks, say, one of the things I find useful is finding someone who you feel is that, and then trying to embody what they must feel like. You know, be that like if someone famous or someone you know, how would they walk? How would they feel? What would their inner world be? What would their sense of themselves be? How would they walk through the you know, the shopping center? How would they feel as they're walking through there? What would be their kind of inner world and radiate that feeling? Three, place that feeling in your heart center or wherever feels right for you. The heart center feels right for me and it's there for a lot of people, but mightn't be for you. And then with an out-breath, let it explode and surround you all around. So you pervade yourself in this kind of feeling of whatever it is, sexiness, good-lookingness, hope, joy, whatever. Then make it shine or radiate outwards from you, projecting it from your body and out into the world. Number four, try to keep this feeling surrounding for as long as you can, but do not strain. Always keep it gentle. Repeat each morning and during the day as often as you remember. You even can try as you talk or interact with people and see if you notice any reaction. The very first time I did this was when I was at school, was secondary school or high school as Americans call it. And I was about trying to feel good about myself and be attractive and stuff like that. And I did this and I kind of radiated. At the time, it was Brad Pitt that I was kind of, he seems like the person people think are good looking. So I kind of tried to not mimic him. Now, it's not a mimic thing. You're not doing an impression of this person. You're not trying to be Brad Pitt or someone who doesn't date me as a near 50-year-old man. It's not an impression. It's just trying to feel, what would someone who is as confident as I think someone like Brad Pitt is or as good looking, how would they feel? And it's that. It's you're mimicking in a sense or you're trying to encapsulate that rather than doing an impression. And I would say I did it every day and I did a lot. I really tried to radiate it, really tried to give this kind of push into my aura. And after about 2 weeks, there was one day where a number of people started commenting on how good I look, how much I've changed, how, you know, things like that. It's a long time ago, but it's like there was like a number of people, like three or four people in one day when it was nearly exactly, you know, 2 weeks or whatever after. I was going, that's interesting. And so it's not going to be immediate if you try this. It's something you have to work on for at least a while. Grant Morrison says, you know, all magic works in threes, 3 days, 3 hours, 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years, three lifetimes. But this, it seems to be a number of weeks of doing it and then you kind of become that and something you've overridden the programming that you have. But of course, if you don't keep it up, the habitual stuff will come back in, you know. So that's why you have to keep that with the cleansing, the and the banishings or whatever, you know, the clearing out kind of stuff as well. And just a kind of final one is come back to Stuart Wilde and the quickening. And this is his kind of overall turbo thought idea of how to do, you know, something similar, you know, how to do this radiating thing. But it's kind of a good way, if you want to, how to just do general magic. So I'll just read it. In a meditative state, place your concentration at the root chakra, at the base of the spine, in the genital region, and slowly pull from that base, with your mind, a quantum of energy. You can visualize it as a ball of light. See that energy moving slowly up an imaginary line through the center of your body, like an elevator. You will have decided prior to this which of the three chakras, heart, throat or third eye, is your strongest. You can't use your crown chakra for turbo thought. Then, as you move the life force up your body, stop it once it reaches the chosen chakra and hover it there for a moment. Allow the energy of the chakra and the energy that you have raised from root to mix. By now, that image of light will be held slightly outside your body at a distance of about an inch. Place inside that pellet of energy your visualized intention. Allow the etheric energy that you have collected from the root to infuse your image so that the visualization becomes a hologram, so that within every atom of the etheric energy there is contained a complete image of the whole. Feel that image excited and intensified by the life force. Then, when you have held the image inside the pellet of energy and you have hovered it there for a brief moment to stabilize it, you are ready to fire the turbo thought. In firing it, you explode it all around you, top to bottom, left to right, behind and in front, so that the energized hologram of your visualization enters every molecule of what you are. In this way, every minute, part of your mind, body, spirit now contains the image of your new circumstances. Your destiny patterns, which lays all around you in your etheric, now contain the new possibility as fact. To explode the thought, expel from your mouth a short burst of air that you originate from the lower diaphragm, like a forceful sigh. As you express it, your stomach muscles will contract. The sigh will be akin to a sniff, except that you are exhaling rather than inhaling. Simultaneously, see the pellet with your image in it explode, blasting and radiating through your entire being. Once the explosion is completed, release the idea and do not think about it for at least 72 hours. And that works very well. I've done that a number of times, and it's very similar, of course, to the radiating aura technique. You can see exactly where my technique originated, or where I stole it from, whatever you want to look, where I was influenced by. And this kind of idea of visualizing an outcome, but imbuing it with both like prana, or vril, or, you know, whatever, rauch, the life force or whatever. And, you know, adding in, I would say, the feelings, even smells, the touches, that make it as real as possible. The emotions behind it, how you feel, seems to really add to the effectiveness of all of this. And so, just to conclude, I want to just go back over what it is that I actually personally think thought forms are. I think thought forms are ideas that you imbue with feelings and emotions and then release into the world by deliberate action or your own intention, or, you know, by an actual state, a heightened state, you know, that you can release these things into the world by being angry, be upset, and then they become kind of hang around and they become habitual ways of looking at the world, but they're also kind of there in your auric field and skew the view of your world. And these can be positive or negative, you know. I mean, if you want some good thought forms, just stuff for, you know, healing, gratitude, positivity, better, you know, have a better idea. And I think the only thing that really does change the world is ideas. And so having better ideas and putting better thought forms out there into the world is an act of service, and it's one of the things that in the Arcane School is part of, you know, part of the whole deal, is that it is part of your work as a server, is to put better thoughts and thought forms out into the world rather than the ones that we have that are in some way, you know, as we know, limiting or making us delusional about the world or causing problems. And the way to do that is just to work on the ones that are around you that you're aware of. And work on the ones that come from your family, from your immediate surroundings, your past, your own clouded judgments, your own failings, all these. Work on all of them and replace them with better ones, or cleanse them or clear them or whatever. I don't think thought forms are demons, personally, but I'm open to the idea. I think by calling these things entities, or elevating to that, you know, kind of stature. You're giving them power that they don't have. It's, you know, you're elevating them, you're externalizing something, you're making it have a power over you that is harder to deal with. It's like kind of saying, it's, you know, it's rather than going, I'm a jealous person, it's like seeing jealousy as an outside force, as a spirit that's acting upon you. And it's a, in a kind of a way, it's bypassing your responsibility in some way, and it's making it as if it's an external force. And of course, the extreme dysfunctional version of that is saying that it's not me, Satan made me do it, or something like that. But again, it's hard and fast rules. Maybe there is demonic forces that work in a similar way to thought forms or servitors or tulpas or egregores or something like that. I'd say I'm open to it, but I think it's probably mostly unhelpful to think of it that way, in that it can be very disabilitating and again makes it harder to deal with something, apart from the times when it would make it much easier to deal with, where you can get your complete chaos magic robes on and go after these demons and bind them and make them your bitch. That could work too, you know, but I think for the average human being, I don't think seeing these samskaras, patterns, neuroses, etc. as demons is probably the most helpful way. Look into the kind of nature of pendulums. It's very interesting to see these, you know, kind of patterns, vortexes of energy that you can very easily get sucked into and you know, become part of the rule set that, you know, just the influence that these things can have in you are very real. And we can kind of say, oh, this kind of pseudoscience-y thought forms. But even if there are just metaphorical, figurative ways of describing group dynamics, it's still an interesting and helpful, for me anyway, way to look at it. Again, with the pendulum stuff, there is this kind of notion of externalizing and giving away your power to, you know, seeing it as an entity. But, you know, maybe. So, yeah, and the things that you can try, apart from, you know, engaging these things and have a thinking about them, is that thing of trying to get people to say words. That's an interesting one, by using Uncle Stew's turbo thought idea of injecting these words into people's minds, or these ideas into people's minds. Again, you're going to have to go with your own moralistic view on it, on what's appropriate. The getting people to turn around by visualizing or turbo thoughting, licking their neck, the back of their neck. Try that. That's interesting. That's fun. And I mean, while you're not certainly getting their consent to do it, I don't think you're intruding too much. I mean, you could just shout at them and get them to turn around, and I don't think their lives would be drastically ruined because of it. So a simple trying to get someone to turn around, I don't think you're imposing on them too much. And the stick and the silver dollar one's interesting as well. As I say, I wasn't ever really too successful with that. But again, it's not something I spend an awful lot of time with. So maybe that's something that you might want to try, to see if you can visualize something in your mind and get someone else to not necessarily even see it, but become aware of it, or, you know, notice it. Maybe the releasing stuff from your own kind of planetary orbit or whatever, very, very helpful. I find that very helpful, and there's even a kind of a physical thing that I can feel when that's happening. That's worth doing, particularly as a meditative practice, as is the, you know, the radiating auric technique, or the turbo thought of Stuart Wilde, of releasing the new kind of circumstances, the new kind of person or a particular type of energy, whatever it is, into your aura, and then kind of radiating that out and trying to present that to the world. Again, not as an impression, but as an actual kind of how would the, you know, had the feeling, the emotion and that kind of stuff behind it. And if you haven't created a servitor, try it. They're quite helpful, and I would suggest attention as the thing that feeds them, because it's the easiest thing to switch off, you know, and it's also easy to give. There's plenty of other kind of ideas of what you can do to feed them, but and I think that one of the things that about servitors is try, and people say that you should have housed them in something, you know, and I've tried different things where I've housed them in like Funko Pop dolls or stones or statues or something like that. But I think if you can have just a sigil or an image or something that's portable, or something that doesn't necessarily have a complete physical, you know, a very separate physical thing, in that it's a statue, you know, yeah, it's only there. Because it's like, if you have something for luck, will you only be lucky around that statue or something? You know, I know that's kind of, it's not really how it works, but if you can have something that's a bit more malleable, a bit more everywhere, you know, all, you know, like a sigil or, you know, a visualization or something like that to house them in. You know, but they do need something, you know, they need some sort of focal point. But kind of mess with that, explore and, you know, expand on those different things and see how you get on. I would advise against tulpas. They don't seem to work out for people. And if you do, you know, do something with a tulpa, then, you know, have a strict kind of policy of who's in charge, in the same way you would with a pet. You know, you wouldn't let your dog run rampant all over the house, or at least you shouldn't. So then, total conclusion, I think thought forms, in all their many different guises, be they egregores, servitors, ideas, fashions, trends, memes, propagandas, shadows, roles, cultural and, you know, societal, moralistic outlooks, all of these things, are the stuff that we most, are the most powerful thing and the thing that affect us the most. And it's something we could probably spend a bit more time thinking about, what thoughts we are surrounding ourselves with, what ideas we surround ourselves with, what we are interacting, how they are clouding our world view, how they are clouding our experience of life, how we they're making us delusional about it, how they're making us sad, unhappy, or whatever it is, and then countering it with better ideas, better thoughts, deliberately making better thought forms, deliberately making things that will improve, you know, and try to change the world, and see them as an act of service to put better things out in the world, you know, literally. And it's something that is actionable, something that we can do, and something that we can, in our own sphere of influence, we can, you know, actually do, you know, the tend to the part of the garden that you can reach and all of that. And so I hope this little discussion on my current thoughts around thought forms has been helpful to you, and maybe has give you some insight into things, maybe not, maybe it doesn't go deep enough. There's certainly other things that I would have liked to talk about, but, you know, I can't go on forever. Like, you know, at what point are God's thought forms and what point are they not? I suppose I can answer that simply and go as I think some of them are thought forms, but I think some of them are actual things. Like, for instance, Ganesha, it doesn't seem like it's a thought form. It seems like it's an actual thing from my understanding or my kind of experience anyway. Yeah, it's just like, yeah, there's many different ideas, many different kind of ways of looking at it. And I said at the beginning, an awful lot of things overlap. When does a sigil become a servitor? When does a servitor become an egregore? When does an egregore become a pendulum? When does a pendulum become a demon? When does a demon become a god? When is any of this, you know, becomes any of it, you know? And just this whole kind of notion of thoughts as things, or thoughts with feelings, ideas being the things that are the most powerful aspect of our lives, and really engaging with that. And I don't think, you know, that having an hour talking about it is really touching anything more than the surface of the whole thing. I think, you know, it kind of maybe the whole idea of thought forms has been kind of reduced to kind of a low resolution thing of, you know, positive thinking or putting the idea to the universe or, you know, the seekers and all of that. It's kind of, in one sense, taking this conversation off the table a bit, in because that's what the association is, you know. And I think there's a higher resolution conversation, if you want to have, around these things that involve creativity, that involve art, that involves visualization, that involves outcomes that are, you know, everything starts with a thought. Everything starts with a thought, and then it becomes manifested. And we can either be subject to that, or we can, you know, be in control of that, or at least try in some way to conduct it in our favor as best we can. So before I start rambling, well, who am I kidding? I've been rambling for a while now. But before I start to ridiculously ramble, let's wrap it up there. And if you have any thoughts about thought forms, if you have any forms about thoughts, and yeah, please let me know. Send me an email, leave a message in all the various places, and let's, you know, continue this conversation. So that was episode 3 on thought forms. I did have extensive notes. I had them in front of me. I think I got through most of the things that I wanted to talk about, but again, only ever going to be touching the surface with these things. And just my current thoughts, you know, as I said previously, I'm trying my best not to hold on to anything, to not have a firm position on any of these things, so that then all outcomes and all things are open to me and I don't have to become so contracted and one-pointed. And I hope that I have in some way added to the conversation rather than just reiterated stuff that's been said over and over again in many different, you know, places, in many different ways. If you enjoyed this podcast, please check out the previous podcast. I've been doing podcasts for a number of years, and if you go to the feed, you will see that there's any amount of podcasts, starting with the Tommy Kelly podcast, all the way through the COVID diaries, through many vlogs and, you know, many things or whatever. Plenty that are in the feed if you are so inclined to listen to them. I do many other things. I write blogs, I write and draw comics, I do music. I have plenty of things that I do that if you would like to support and help me continue to do, I would really appreciate it. And support comes in many different ways. It doesn't just mean money, although the money certainly helps, but liking, sharing, annoying people about it, sending it, you know, writing comments, leaving reviews, even just, you know, putting in ratings and stuff like that. All of that, like, it's ridiculously helpful. It really is. Even if, you know, at the minute, because algorithms are so weird on social media, even just in any way interacting with, you know, general social media posts that are put up, really helps, you know, to get to see it. At the minute, I have like something like 25,000 follows on one Facebook page, and whatever it is, 4,500 friends on my actual profile, and posts get seen by about 20 people. You know, it's just, that seems to be the nature of these things. Unless you're being shocking or saying something controversial, no one sees any of the posts. So if you like people and creators and stuff, make sure to, when you read posts, whatever, just send a like, say yes, or leave a comment, anything, just to interact with it. It really does help. Of course, if you do want to send some money, I would gladly take it. There's the Patreon, which there's loads of stuff there. I post nearly every day on Patreon, apart from the weekend, which is, that's family time, that's me time. There's loads of stuff. There's the Journey, which is a year-long shadow working course. There is daily readings. There is the Blog Redux series, where I look back at the blog posts I've wrote over the last 10 years of doing adventures in WooWoo. Well, 9 years. Sounds better to say 10 years. And, you know, see whether I agree or disagree with them or have anything further to add. There's loads of stuff that's over there if you want to sign up and help me out in that way. Or you can just, you know, send me a PayPal donation. You can buy me a book off my Amazon wishlist. You can buy me something off my bigger Amazon wishlist. Or any of these things, all in the show description, if you so please. But I do offer all of this for free. You can use the 47s absolutely for free. There's a whole free resource where everything that you would need to do magic or divination with the 47s is there. All of my blogs are free. All of the podcasts are free. All of the YouTube stuff is free. So plenty to keep you company if you want. So, good people of the internet, I am quite drained energy-wise at the moment, but not in a bad way. Just in a, I've been recording for a while and trying to get these ideas out, and I'm just a bit zonked, but in a good way. So, good people of the internet, my blessing for you is that may you be surrounded by good thoughts rather than bad thoughts. May the forms your thoughts come in, bring you peace, ease, happiness, joy, fulfillment, understanding, rather than restriction. And may we all have better thoughts and bring these better thoughts into the world, so that those who come after us and those who surround us have better lives than we did. That we can bring more light into this world than there was before we got here. And may our best days be ahead. And be well.